Good morning. One in five Americans has mental illness, yet the stigma persists. Filmmaker Rick Goldsmith is looking to change that with his documentary, Mind Game. He joins us in a few minutes. And does that smartphone in your hand bring you closer to other people or impede your ability to enjoy solitude? Later this hour, we'll talk with visiting Professor Scott Campbell about the social effects of mobile communications. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Classical guitarist Luke Trimble is preparing a sold-out weekend concert that features music written to highlight the guitar. And if you want diverse cinema, look no further than the 14th annual Temple Emmanuel Kirk Kashmir Jewish Film Festival. Andrea Snyder is a member of the selection committee, and she's here with a preview.
It's Leap Day, Monday, February 29th. We'll talk about those conversations in just a little bit. Next, the news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning and happy Leap Day to you.
I was going to say, Sadie Hawkins Day, right?
Oh, really? So I could ask someone to marry me and it would be perfectly okay.
Should you be so inclined?
Well, we'll just keep that one to ourselves.
That's right.
All right. Well, we're going to kick off with some conversation for you this morning. Now, chances are that someone in your personal or your work life deals with it. It is mental illness. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, approximately one in five adults in the U.S. experiences mental illness in a given year. That's 43.8 million people, or 18.5% of our national population in all walks of life. The prevalence of mental illness may seem inconsistent with the stigma that still persists, and it's why some are approaching education and policy change through the medium of film. That would include producer-director Rick Goldsmith. His latest film is Mind Game, focuses on mental illness, and he joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
In trying to get people to understand how prevalent mental illness really is, some say it's very helpful to have people who are well-known talk about it. Others say that it's sort of like, oh, well, there goes one more celebrity talking about his or her problems. With the story that you're telling of WNBA of champ Monique, Chamonix Holdsclaw, is that something that you've had to encounter with people who look at this story and say, well, there goes another celebrity trying to talk to us about problems or really talking about how prevalent this really is?
Well, I think that Chamiqua Holdsclaw is somewhat unique in the celebrity world and the sports world in that she was really the best of the best when she was playing in the late 90s. The women's best player ever is what they called her, the female Michael Jordan. And when she began to grapple in a big way with her mental health problems when she was in the pros a few years later, it was big news then. The turning point for her, because she really succumbed to the things that most people succumb to, shame, stigma, denial. The turning point for her was she finally realized after an attempted suicide attempt, hey, I need help. And she began to not only deal with her own issues, but she began to speak about them publicly. And she would go around to audiences all over the country, some sports audiences, college audiences, general audiences, and really open up the conversation. The whole point being to take away the stigma and say to people, I don't want you to go through the same thing I did. You might be struggling with mental illness, but don't put on top of that denial and stigma and refuse to get help.
Well, so, go ahead.
In answer to your question, she was different. It wasn't like, oh, she just pops onto the scene and she's a celebrity suddenly talking about it. She lived it. She talked about it. And she's, to this day, a real advocate for education and that idea of getting help.
for a lot of young people who are confronting mental illness, and in particular those who are in the age group where it starts to show up, that you know, from you know late teens into the 20s, there's still a great deal of shame in talking about it, even contemplating that mental illness could be part of their lives, and not wanting to really discuss it with other people. For all the work that's been done on mental illness, we're often told that there's so much more to do to maybe to make this something that is as acceptable as talking about you know any other form of physical illness. How far do you think we are away from being able to do that?
It's a journey. It's a journey like she went through a journey. I think there's probably more happening now. There's more education. There's more awareness of mental illness. And there's less taboo than there's ever been. And it is still a monumental problem. And it's probably one of the biggest social issues in this country that we face. And by that, I mean the difficulty in addressing the issue on a conversational level, in the media, and in social public policy.
In changing policy, what do you think has to happen to be able to allow us to have those conversations more openly? What has to be the focus or the pivot so that we can understand how much this is affecting the people that are in our lives?
I think it's like any other social issue. It has to happen on virtually every level, from the personal level to, you know, and by that I mean being able to speak about it in families, and that's one of the things that I think this film addresses and Shamiqua addresses and I address, which is you have to open up the conversation with the people closest to you. If they're family members and you see somebody who maybe seems to be slipping away, seems to be troubled in a way that you don't quite understand, don't be afraid to approach that person and say, hey, what's going on? You seem different, you know, or even bring up, you know, are you thinking of hurting yourself? Are you thinking of killing yourself? Those kinds of conversations. So that's level number one. Level number two is on a community level to make sure in our schools, our churches, people aren't afraid to address these issues. And taking up to the next level, speaking about it in the media, like we're doing right now, having people write about it. I was part of a mental health journalism fellowship through the Carter Center, named after Rosalind Carter, who as First Lady really addressed these issues 40 years ago. And this fellowship, my fellows were journalists from all over the country, even outside the country, who were writing about mental health issues. So that's the next level up. And then on the policy level, it needs to be discussed with people who make public policy, whether that's you know Obamacare, which actually does write into the law parity between mental health issues and health issues needs to be written into the law, but how that actually gets affected in practice is a much larger journey. So people have to push on every level. And the last thing I'll say about that is I might make a parallel between some of the gay issues, gay marriage, which 5 years ago nobody thought that gay marriage would be legal universally in this country. And it was talked about on every level, like I was just talking about here. Personal level, people in their families, people who know gay people, people who are gay people talking about it. And that's how those social political issues get changed.
You're really calling for those who are coping with mental illness and those people around them from policy levels on down and from the grassroots on up to open their mouths and say something. And lose some of that fear, which can be very tough to do when you're opening yourself to potentially, you know, being ridiculed by others or simply shamed into silence.
Yes, that's true. And, you know, some of it is, you know, personal fear. And if you can get past that, that's a wonderful thing. Some of it is real. There's job discrimination. There's housing discrimination that takes place every day in every community if people reveal that they're struggling with mental illness. So the consequences can be dire. And again, that's true with any social issue. I wouldn't take it upon myself to say, hey, you need to do more, speak about your mental illness. That's got to be a personal decision. But there are more and more people doing it, and there are more and more organizations that people can find, organizations like Active Minds and the Jed Foundation and Bring Change to Mind, and of course NAMI, which is the largest mental health, mental illness organization in the country, that can give support to people like that who want to break free and want to make a difference.
And their families, too. Rick Goldsmith, I wish we had much more time to talk, but wishing you all the best with the next showing of the film Mind Game, and all the best to you.
Yes, it'll be showing on Wednesday night.
We've got it showing Wednesday night at the Doris Duke Theater, and we'll talk more about that and give you more details on our Facebook page. That was producer-director Rick Goldsmith, longtime filmmaker and two-time Academy Award nominee, talking about mental health and the subject of his latest film, Mind Game.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:15. Coming up, a visit with classical guitarist Luke Trimble. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're recalling the site of a rare seismic event, an earthquake swarm. In the summer of 1996, a total of 4,070 earthquakes were recorded there, more earthquakes than at any other such event in the recorded history of the islands. The site was an active undersea volcano located about 22 miles off the southeast coast of Hawaii Island. The peak of the seamount is about 3,000 feet below the surface, rising from the flank of Mauna Loa, the largest shield volcano on Earth. This volcano, whose name means long in Hawaiian, is the newest volcano in the Hawaiian Emperor Seamount chain, a string of volcanoes that stretches over 5,800 kilometers to the northwest. It began forming around 400,000 years ago and is expected to emerge above sea level between 10,000 and 100,000 years from now. At its summit, it stands more than 10,000 feet above the seafloor, making it taller than Mount St. Helens before its 1980 eruption. This morning, we're looking for the name of this impressive undersea mountain, and we'll be back with it in half hour. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and there's an HPR t-shirt in it for the first correct caller.
Good morning. I'm Denise Conan from the College of Social Sciences at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The guitar is an ideal instrument for chamber music, where the sound of acoustic instruments, heard without amplification, can be savored. Luke Trimble will be bringing his guitar, along with an ensemble of chamber players from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, to an ideal acoustical environment this weekend in a concert of chamber music written to highlight the classical guitar's unique sonorities And Luke's with us this morning. Good morning, Luke.
Good morning.
You can get an awful lot out of a nylon string guitar, which most people would think is exists at a certain volume and tonal range, but you can get loud, you can get soft, you can do a lot, can't you?
Yes, you can, and it's it blends very well with the string family.
Exactly. What I like about chamber music, Luke, is that you're invited to tune in on individual instruments, right?
Yes, and for our concerts this coming weekend, we've got some music for guitar and violin. Mm-hmm. We get to feature just the Rachel Saul and myself, guitar and cello, and then we'll wrap it up with a string quintet.
So that gives you a huge tonal range, too.
You'll get a little bit of everything, yeah. We're going to span a few centuries, and what's nice about this program is the music's written especially for the guitar. When the composer sat down to write this music, he had the guitar in mind mm-hmm. to begin with. And there's a lot of nuance and color that the classical guitar can bring to chamber music, and they really accentuate that.
Has the writing of music for classical guitar, has that grown, wrote music specifically for classical guitar, has that expanded in recent decades?
Yes, but barely. I think the classical guitar, we've been trying to stand on our own 2 feet on the concert stage as a soloist for a few decades, going back to Andres Segovia. That was one thing he was really trying to push. And I feel like they've done that. But as far as chamber music goes, it seems like a lot of composers will write maybe one piece or two pieces. A lot of people are writing in, you know, the key of A or the key of D. It seems like
guitar-friendly keys,
and they really haven't pushed the envelope quite as much as I'd like to. I'm hoping to spotlight, you know, the guitar in this type of environment, and maybe we can get some more music out of it.
Well, in the days of where he really pioneered guitar as a concert instrument, Segovia did a lot of transcriptions of works written for other instruments, right?
He did. He took a lot of Bach cello suites and things like that. And it really helped expand the guitar, helped it get to the concert stage.
Luke, we've got a little excerpt from your CD to play. Let's play just about a minute or so of that, give an idea of what we're talking about. Now, in that piece, Luke, you and the cello are kind of tossing the melody back and forth, aren't you?
We are, and as great as the cello and guitar sounds together, there's a lot of contrast. On the guitar, you pluck the strings, and it immediately decays. And on the cello and the violin, they have a bow. They have so much sustain.
Yeah.
And getting those very different sounds to complement each other can be challenging. It also can be very rewarding. It's got a really neat sound.
And that's the trick in adapting to the guitar, is knowing that the note is going to be on a downward trajectory as soon as you let it out, right?
Absolutely.
At the same time, bowing allows you to actually have a note grow after you've originated it, which, at least on acoustic guitar, is pretty much impossible.
It is. I wish sometimes I could bow my guitar for that reason, but it's a wonderful blend of sound.
What are the ways in which you sort of humanize a note on the guitar? You know, you have to put a lot of a kind of a tremble with your fingers to give it that vocal quality. What is it you do with a melody?
The classical guitar is exceptional or different from your other acoustic guitars, electric guitars, most notably because we play with our fingernails in our right hand. It's a mm-hmm. combination of nail and flesh, and we depress the string and pluck the string in a way that allows us to get a lot of different color mm-hmm. on the guitar. And where you place your right hand on the strings changes the sound dramatically. And that with the nails, you can use the back of the nails for flamenco techniques, and you can really make it sing because we use our nails like that.
So you can, if you're just touching with the flesh of your finger, that's a warmer sound, but it doesn't jump out quite as much.
You can really make it sing or have a real round tone, we might say.
A lot of options available within what would seem to be a limited environment, but that's the whole idea of studying the instrument.
Yeah, right? And this group, too, it's a wildly talented group, and I think everybody's got a really wonderful handle on how their instrument's going to play out for this concert.
Well, this is going to be exciting because it's a very good environment for acoustic music as well, the wood-paneled room we've got upstairs.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much for coming in, Luke. Looking forward to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Luke Trimble and an ensemble of chamber players from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra will perform a concert of chamber music written especially for guitar Saturday evening and an additional show Sunday, March 6th at 4 p.m. It'll include Luigi Boccherini's quintet for guitar and strings, along with music for guitar and violin by Astor Piazzolla, Hector Villalobos, Terry Riley, and Niccolo Paganini, as well as new music for guitar and cello by Brian Johansson.
Day of reckoning, depending on how you spell wreck. Voters in 11 states on Tuesday answer these questions. Can Cruz hold his home state of Texas? Will Rubio's boat float in Florida? Will Trump sink in Boston Harbor? Where can Bernie win? How can Hillary lose? Politics coming up all this week on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation. Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Theater Center, presenting the traditional Irish instrumental music of Lunasa with Tim O'Brien, 7:30 p.m. Thursday, March 10th. Tickets at hawaiitheater.com.
For the fourth year in a row, HPR has been recognized with 4 stars by the nation's largest charity evaluator. Charity Navigator's top rating can give you confidence that your donation will be used efficiently and responsibly. We thank these members who have recently shown us their trust and support. Aaron Pohl of Honolulu, Dale and Victoria Machado of Kaneohe, and Abigail Langless of Honolulu. You can find the link to our Charity Navigator ranking at hawaiipublicradio.org, and we'd be happy to answer your questions about giving to HPR when you call us at 955-8821 during business hours. And thanks. Police Major Ryan Borges removed his name from consideration as assistant chief after a 1993 assault on his wife became public, but that hasn't stopped an older domestic violence case from surfacing or a question about why that other incident wasn't revealed in the public discussion. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has more of the story in today's Reality Check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
So why didn't we not hear anything about that 1989 case?
That's the question that we have for Chief Louis Kealoha and for Major Ryan Borges. We did not hear back from them. Our reporter Nick Gruby uncovered this earlier case. Let me just quickly describe it. We all know about what happened in 93, about him pulling a gun during an argument with his wife. But in 1989, a woman who was living with him was admitted to Castle Medical Center in Kailua. She had bruised ribs, bleeding from her inner ear cavity. And it appears in many ways that it could have been a domestic violence situation, being punched by Borges. The case, however, turned over to Internal Affairs, but then later dropped. The woman never intended, apparently, for police to be involved in the case. But the big question here is, why didn't Chief Kealoha or Borges let us know about this? When Kealoha said he wanted to have Borges be his assistant chief, he acknowledged the 93 incident and made it seem like that was the only thing that ever happened, that he had learned from the experience and moved on. But that's got some people, particularly folks that pay attention to HPD and worry about domestic violence, whether they're actually taking seriously domestic violence against women.
And trying to balance that off the fact that, you know, does someone actually learn from that experience? Has there been enough help to be able to move on from that experience and not have it color the rest of one's life? That seems to be a little bit fuzzy.
Yeah, these are the kind of things that we want to know more about. By the way, though, the woman wanted, after the 93 incident, the person that was his wife wanted to know whether her husband would pursue counseling for his drinking. We didn't see any information about that either, other than he's learned and moved on. But this is a very serious situation. Think about the Cachola case, the one involving the videotape at the mm-hmm. restaurant. Remember, was it play acting, or was the officer actually beating up on his female companion? These are the kind of things that have people wondering whether they take this issue seriously. And then imagine when those cops have to intervene in a case. Are they already predisposed to thinking domestic violence is not a big deal when they show up on call?
And when it maybe potentially involves another officer.
Yeah, exactly. Do they just look the other way?
At this point, we don't have answers to any of those questions, but we're just continuing to ask the questions and see what happens from this point forward. But is there anything that you've seen come from HPD?
No, they didn't even provide someone else to talk about the 1989 case. Nick did try. And by mm-hmm. the way, it was a public records request, which is how we learned about the earlier incident. But no, silence from HPD on domestic violence allegations of anyway.
Well, and not from us in the conversation. Thanks so much.
No, sir.
We'll talk to you tomorrow. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Beth.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat and joins us daily for a reality check.
At 8:30, you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Chris Vandercook. Talk back about what you hear on the show to our talk back line at 808-792-8217. Find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or on Twitter at HI Conversation. And tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, heart blockages can be dealt with in a couple of different ways, yeah?
You got it. And today is sort of the conclusion of our 5 weeks of cardiac topics for February. And we're going to be talking about heart stents versus surgery. We've talked about things that affect heart. We've talked about different types of reasons why people get blockages. And today the culmination is going to be, if you have a blockage, if you're having a heart attack or at risk for it, how is it determined that you can have a minimally invasive procedure versus having an open surgery? What are the criteria that doctors use, and what can you do when you're told this information?
There are more and more situations in which stents are deemed appropriate, right?
There are. In fact, so many people qualify to get stents because it's less invasive, and it also can help to protect them from having problems with blocked blood flow issues right then and there. But we're going to talk about what happens when you have too many blockages, and is there any way to truly reverse heart disease once you have it? We started off our February with talking about the Dean Ornish diet, the reversal of heart disease diet, and we're going to culminate with when you actually have it and somebody tells you you need to do something, like a procedure, where do you go from there?
Well, diet really can make a difference no matter what stage you're at, right?
It really can. It really can. But there is a point where you've gone past the point of no return, mm-hmm. where if you really need to have an open heart surgery, what does that surgery entail? And what are the benefits and risks in that versus having the stent procedures done? We've talked a little bit about stents this past month, but we're really going to go in depth today.
A lot of people are going to be interested in this, Kathy. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show tonight at 5 with Dr. Kathy Kozak.
Support for The Conversation comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA FlexPlus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Maybe you're like a lot of people who feel incomplete, maybe even a little naked, without your mobile phone. With a record level of mobile communication, we can be in touch all day, every day. But who or what exactly are we in touch with? University of Michigan professor Scott Campbell studies that question and other consequences of our mobile behavior. He teaches telecommunications and communication studies, and this week is speaking at Oahu University campuses. He joins us now. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you for having me.
This little device, whatever you want to, you know, whatever brand mobile phone you carry, smartphone, has so changed the fabric of our lives, and what we define as being public and private seems to be slipping ever away as people find themselves needing to have their mobile phone with them at all times, looking at how that means that they're alone or not alone. Does it make it more so or less? You've been studying this for such a long time. As you look at where we are now, how do you peg us in our attachment to this device and other mobile devices?
Well, first I want to say that I think it's a good question that more people should be asking. One of the analogies that I like to use when talking about mobile communication is the fish in water. I don't think that we are really fully conscious about how much mobile communication has become a part of ourselves and a part of our society. And so right now I'm kind of coming at the questions that you just posed from the perspective of what does it mean that mobile communication really isn't something new anymore? The ability to actively communicate and now exchange information and content while we're physically moving about or taking care of everyday life activities, this is something that's distinctive. It's not the same thing as carrying a laptop around and setting it down at a space that you need to send those flows through. And so, to me, I think that we take it for granted. I have some colleagues that also make this argument, and that we're less conscious, I think, these days as it transitions from this new revolutionary ability to a basic expectation to be a fully functioning citizen and member of your social networks. If you don't have access, you're falling through the cracks.
And access 24/7, I mean, without outing anybody, I can tell you I know people who will not go to the bathroom without taking their mobile phones with them, lest they miss something. Have we lost something in all that?
I think we've gained something, and I think we've lost something, yes. And I think that this is the way it works with technological change in any context, but I see this as a distinctive context. I think that we can talk about new autonomy that we have to organize and coordinate on the fly, but we can also talk about, I think, a lot of things that we are losing. One of the things that I'm interested in is solitude, and very few people are talking about this. Sherry Turkle at MIT has helped open this conversation up some. Usually solitude is considered being physically alone or physically removed from other people. And one of my arguments is that we need to rethink solitude as a matter of communication, whether we're plugged in or not plugged in actively with other people.
That's an argument that may be tough to make with people who feel that they should be connected all the time, or that that's just the way it is, as you've talked about before. And yet, with the loss of being able to be alone and to hear your own voice and to be able to think your own thoughts without the impulse of anyone else or anything else, seems also to be something that we strive for. You know, be an individual, think for yourself. We say those things, and yet we walk around packing a phone.
Right. I think two of the outcomes of mobile communication, two of the trajectories that we're seeing right now is first of all, more communication in our lives. Some people early on argued that it was taking away from being involved outside of your core social networks. And research shows that it doesn't. It basically adds to it. And there might be some things to celebrate about that, being more politically involved, being more engaged in your community, being more engaged with weak ties even, as well as your core ties. But the point is that there's more communication in our lives than we've seen in previous generations. And now that it's not new, we take it for granted, and so it's less conscious. This partially explains why people text while they're driving. They're not entirely fully aware of what they're doing because it's such a part of who they are. It's like second nature. You put those two things together, less consciousness, more communication, and it creates the need for more deliberate solitude, to deliberately carve out those moments where you're alone with your own thoughts and where you're not communicating with people. And I think that's something that needs to be brought to the forefront in terms of our consciousness.
It also seems to be a real answer to why we think that it's not dangerous to be doing that, because it is so unconscious, where you just simply grab for it and think, oh, I have to answer somebody and do it, unless you turn off the phone deliberately, put it away where you can't see it or hear it for the time that you're driving.
Right. We're very cognitively plugged into this technology, and in kind of a latent way that we're not really aware of, I think, sometimes. So phantom vibrations, I think, illustrate this, where you're not consciously thinking about your phone, but you're subconsciously so tied to it that you think it's beckoning you even when it's not. And so you can translate that into texting while driving. People are driving around and they have an emotion, or the phone beckons them, or something happens in their brain and they reach for the phone, or something happens with the technology and they reach for the phone. The cues are ubiquitous. And I think that it is somewhat of a habit that we have now, somewhat of a core expectation that we have of ourselves and that other people have of ourselves and have of us. And part of what explains, I think, texting while driving and using it in other situations like walking or going to the bathroom is that maybe people aren't really thinking so much about it anymore, because it's a taken-for-granted assumption.
But you are asking us to think more about that and what it's doing to the quality of our lives.
Yeah, I mean, I'm coming at it from a unique position because it's my job to teach about this and to write about this, and so I am conscious of it. And I will say that I don't text and drive, but I will say that I absolutely, myself, will use the phone in ways that disappoint myself, or at times when I'm with my 8-year-old son or something like that. So I'm not saying that I'm innocent in this, but yeah, I am trying to help raise some awareness. And I'm not saying this is a bad technology. It's both good and bad and neutral. You know, it's all of it. It depends on how we use it, but we need to think about how we use it.
And that's the whole point, making it mindful. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Forward to hearing you later on this week and tonight.
Thank you. I also want to thank the COM programs, Communication at HPU and UH, for having me.
And I'm sure they appreciate that greatly, too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Scott Campbell is Professor of Telecommunications and Associate Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Michigan. His research helps to explain mobile communication behaviors and consequences. He is the featured guest tonight through March 4th at Oahu University campuses, including a free public lecture today at 4:30 at UH Hamilton Library, and on Wednesday at 5:30 at HPU's Aloha Tower Marketplace.
In today's backyard quiz, we thought about the youngest volcano in the Hawaiian chain, a still active seamount that rises 3,000 meters from the ocean floor. Prior to 1970, it was thought to be extinct, but a series of eruptions in that year surprised scientists and sent UH researchers on an expedition to study an earthquake swarm there. A later swarm in 1996 recorded more than 4,000 separate tremors. The volcano has remained relatively active since then and is monitored by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the United States Geological Survey. The Hawaii Undersea Geological Observatory, or HUGO, provided real-time data on the seamount between 1997 and 2002. The seamount is on track to become the next Hawaiian island. It's expected to emerge from the ocean surface between 10 and 100,000 years from now. So stay tuned. Its name, then as now, will be Lo'ihi.
And we had a winner from Kona. Jeff Walker called in. He knew the answer, and he'll get the T-shirt. At 8:44, that's the answer to today's quiz. And if you've got a backyard quiz for us, write it down. Send it in. We want to see it. Our email address is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Good morning. I'm John Johnson from One Breath Photography. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our very small planet. And as usual, we turn to Christopher Phillips for his expertise. Welcome back, Christopher. What's going on?
Hey, Dave. Good to be back. For this week, stargazers, be sure to look out for those five planets that are still in our morning sky. We have Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. All are extremely bright and very easy to spot. Also, look out for the moon as it approaches its new moon phase this week as our skies get darker.
Now, we have an exciting bit of news this week about a meteor that exploded over, I believe, the Atlantic Ocean recently.
That's absolutely right. So earlier this month, a meteor came in over the Atlantic Ocean and exploded with the force of a small hydrogen bomb, about 13,000 tons of TNT. It exploded far away from the coast of Brazil and the city of Rio de Janeiro, which it passed over.
Now, we talk about this sort of topic a lot on the program, so how was this one spotted or not spotted?
Well, the problem with this particular meteor is that it was small compared to some of the large asteroids that we normally look out for. And this is quite embarrassing considering that recently NASA just opened its Office of Planetary Defense, whose job it is to actually spot objects like this as they approach the Earth.
So this one was not spotted?
It was not. It slipped under the radar, so to speak.
Wow. And about how big do you think it was, Christopher?
So we're actually very uncertain about the size of this object. The only thing that really gives us an indication as to what type of object it was the force with which it exploded. Now, even though 13,000 tons of TNT sounds like a lot, it's nothing compared to the asteroid that exploded over Shablinsk in central Russia a few years ago. That exploded with roughly the force of 500,000 tons of TNT. So that gives you an idea of the difference in size between the two objects.
Man, it's big stuff. Glad it didn't land over one of our houses or something.
100 tons of debris from space fall on planet Earth every single day. Now, most of this stuff is tiny, about the size of a grain of sand, and so it burns up harmlessly in the Earth's upper atmosphere. However, large objects do make it down to Earth as we see, but luckily, most of our planet is covered in water, and so the majority of the objects splash harmlessly into the ocean.
Or explode like this one did, making news.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you very much for the report. It's Christopher Phillips.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from HTA, a public charter school serving students grades K through 12 on each island, providing each student with the opportunity for a personalized learning plan combining face-to-face and virtual instruction. Learn more at myhta.org.
The Jewish experience carries with it lessons for us all. As a people without a homeland for so many centuries, Jews have established a presence in every quarter of the world, as each year's Temple Emanuel Kirkcashmere Jewish Film Festival reminds us. Jewish cinema today is as diverse in its subject matter as it is in its countries of origin. Andrea Snyder was part of the committee that selected this year's slate of film, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning.
I suppose the first question that comes to mind when you look at these films is, how did you know where to begin in picking them out? Yeah,
that's a good question, because there were so many great films. We went through over 60, I believe, to get these eight, and we wanted to have a combination of drama, comedy, suspense, documentary, and I think we really achieved it. I think this is one of our greatest years, this 14th year.
Well, just looking at the true life stories for a minute, there are a couple of amazing ones, one of them being of a Jewish philanthropist starting schools all over America for black people.
That's right. That's the documentary Rosenwald. He was the president of Sears Roebuck. He was inspired by Booker T. Washington to help build over 5,000 schools in Jim Crow South, in the Deep South.
And the other documentary, the one that really caught my eye first, is about a hijacking story that I think most of us have sort of let go by. This is not the Entebbe raid that most people might know about, but the Sabina hijacking 1972.
That's right. And we do have a local connection, too, because Gilad Jankelevich is the executive producer, and he will be at each of the screenings. So It's a docudrama, so there are some recreated and some actual documentary footage, and it's really amazing. Even though you know the outcome, that the negotiations were successful, it's a gripping story.
And the rescue team included two future prime ministers, which I think is pretty amazing in itself, right?
Right. Netanyahu, Shimon Peres, and Barak were part of the
all
team.
All involved in this.
Yes.
Three of them, yeah.
Yes.
Well, and then you, of course, I'm tempted to say it wouldn't be a Jewish film festival without comedy.
That's right. And our opening night film is Dough with Jonathan Pryce. He plays a baker in a bakery that's struggling in London, and he takes on a young Muslim from Darfur who also happens to deal in marijuana and accidentally drops some marijuana in the dough. But it's really a charming story.
So the bakery becomes an inadvertent dispensary, right?
Well, I guess so. It becomes very popular,
yeah.
And the character that Jonathan Pryce plays doesn't know why.
You absolutely wouldn't recognize Jonathan Pryce in this either, at least from what I've seen of the stills from the movie.
Right. It's a great film. It's one not to be missed, and it is being shown six times, including being the opening night film this Saturday.
When you were selecting the movies, Andrea, did you find that out of the selection, once you decided on them, that themes emerged, or did you have themes you were looking for going in?
I think each year is slightly different, so not necessarily did we have themes going in, but mm-hmm. we did want films that were provocative, entertaining, and they really all are, and also with some kind of message or something to think about afterwards, and I think we've succeeded. I think people will be really happy to come and see these.
One of the things that I think, if you only go to movies at the multiplex, I think it would be fair to say that there's a kind of a sameness that's creeping into commercial cinema. Maybe it's always been true, but it seems as if movies are more similar to one another and therefore more predictable than ever before. And I'm talking about the total mainstream big budget movies. So festivals are a kind of a nice alternative to that, aren't they?
They are. And it's a chance to see films that you might not get to see.
Yeah. Now, where do you find them? How do you go about even seeing all these 60 movies that you looked at?
Well, we have a great film curator at the Doris Duke Theater. Mm-hmm. She suggests, plus we all have contacts with other film festivals around the country and in Israel. And so films that we think are worthy of screening, and it really is hard to pick just eight films.
I would imagine, yeah. Are there other festivals around the country devoted to Jewish cinema?
Yes, there are Jewish film festivals in lots of communities, and ours opens this Saturday.
So you've got a database from which to draw then in seeking out these movies.
That's right.
Terrific. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Andrea Snyder is a member of the selection committee for the 14th annual Temple Emmanuel Kirk Kashmir Jewish Film Festival, which runs from March 5th to the 18th, with additional screenings through March 29th at the Honolulu Museum of Art's Doris Duke Theater.
Support for the conversation comes from Hawaii Life Real Estate Brokers, a locally owned company serving Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and the Big Island of Hawaii. Listings and information at hawaiilife.com.
The news can sometimes be overwhelming.
Blanc said France was under attack.
A mass shooting in San Bernardino.
A police officer killing a child.
More than 2 degrees Celsius above what it was.
Total and complete shutdown of Muslims.
Syrian refugees here being put under a magnifying glass.
All Things Considered is here to help you make sense of it all. Listen every afternoon.
Weekday afternoons from noon to 2.
Super Tuesday is big.
A huge portion of delegates is up for grabs.
13 states will decide.
Plus American Samoa and Americans abroad.
So, can Donald Trump be stopped?
Will Hillary Clinton hold on to her lead?
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Join us tomorrow to find out who wins and what it all means.
Live elections coverage from NPR News.
Coverage begins tomorrow afternoon at 3 on HPR 1.
Beth Ann, in your talk with Scott Campbell, he was very eloquent about the seductive qualities of the smartphone and how it kind of draws you in often when you shouldn't be drawn in.
Well, yeah, and the should or shouldn't is really what he's asking us to think about in making mindful communication and not necessarily knee-jerk or feeling that incompleteness unless you walk it around with the smartphone in your hand no matter where you go.
Well, the trouble is that might well extend to when you're behind the wheel, and even new cars now are incorporating screens into the dashboard and things that invite you to integrate your smartphone into the operations and basically invite you to look at things other than what's on the other side of your windshield.
And his point is that becomes sort of an unconscious draw, and you don't truly understand why you're doing it, but you are doing it, even though you may understand full well that these are very dangerous and, as you say, seductive calls.
Yeah, I think anyone who's ever been tempted to look at a screen or a phone screen while driving has had that sensation of feeling that he looked at it a little too long and you kind of snap back to the road and you think, well, that could have gone bad, as it often does.
And that same idea is what he's applying to the idea of solitude. You know, do we really have solitude when we're simply alone and not with other people, or when we unplug, including from our phones? And what does that mean to our own development and our own communication?
Well, you can get a lot out of solitude if you know how to handle it, that's for sure.
The question is, do we?
Yeah.
And are we losing that ability? We'll talk more tomorrow about other good conversations that you might want to join us to hear. It is Super Tuesday. We're going to check in with Neil Conan.
And we'll have two brilliant jazz musicians, saxophonist Joe Lovano and guitarist John Schofield, will visit us in our studio.
In the meantime, if you want to be in touch, you can leave us our comments at 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Or you can post your comments on Facebook. Our page is Hawaii Conversation. We tweet at HI Conversation. I tweet at BKOZHPR.
And if you missed any of the show or want a past one, you can find them under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning right here for more of the conversation.